Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about full focus and full compliance to the Constitution. We want to make sure that everything we do, everything that we are pursuing in our politicians and everything is all about full compliance, not just, oh, Second Amendment. And I've gone through these rants on all this stuff, so I don't want to belabor the point. I want to get into the content because I've already got a go back because kind of mentioned this towards the end of yesterday's show. But before I do, I wanted to just at least send some love towards Gerald Wistrand. He is the single campaign that is basically committed to being a champion of full compliance of the Constitution. Therefore, I'm just asking folks, if you would, if you can, please give him some support financially any way you can. I mean, shoot, if you can drive down there and, you know, directly support him, I'm sure he'd take that too. Any type of support, right? Anyhow, welcome back, Sean. And so when we went into the end, I started rattling off about how unique New York was. And there's an old saying, you are what you eat. And I think more aptly, you are, you know, based on, you know, your culture. Your culture helps form you. The culture of your family, the culture of your community, the culture of your state. Your state is a greater community. And then this culture of the nation, Britain at that time. And so when we look at Alexander Hamilton, we can't be surprised that he had a paradigm that was based upon, you know, his cultures, his community, as well as the state. He was a licensed, or, you know, he had his JD and was practicing law in the state of New York. He was very interested and very ambitious in trying to create a national government. And it was very clear, we covered this already this year in going through the notes, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, that when Hamilton spoke, you know, what his plan was, his plan and his desire was to create a government just like Britain. I mean, he basically, you know, it was a brown, I mean, I just, excuse the expression if you feel offended, he was a brown noser. He was a sycophant for the crown and the government form of Britain, which was more of a monarchical theocracy with an aristocracy legislative body. Anywho, so I just wanted to kind of go through the different configurations of the states. And out of all 13 states, there were 10 states that had the legislative body had the principal oversight and responsibilities over the judicial functions of the state. In other words, if there was a judicial government or if there was a judicial branch, which they didn't really have a judicial, they may have just set up courts. The courts may have been district courts. The courts may have been independent, like we said with New York. But those were where they actually had delegated authority over to the court, just like in Britain, where the court was an active function. But in New York, I don't think they had necessarily legislative powers, but that was the British model, using common law, case law, precedent, so forth. They were literally creating law, and I would think that that was happening in New York. But out of these states that I mentioned, how many was it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So there's 10 states that had a very limited judiciary. Most of them, in some cases, you know, the judiciary was appointed by the governor or appointed by the legislature, or the legislature did the job. Even in the description of the legislative body in these 10 states, they either call themselves the General Assembly or the Supreme Council and the Supreme Court. I think New Jersey was the Assembly served as the Supreme Court. And there were some other ones that actually considered itself the Supreme Court or the General Court, Georgia, Connecticut, Massachusetts, so forth and so on. So when you look at who the Supreme Court was in almost all of these states, even Massachusetts, because Massachusetts was not one of the 10, but Massachusetts still considered itself as the Supreme Court. In other words, all the final verdicts would come out of the legislative body. Just want you to understand that the legislature in a Republican form of government were the almighty, all-powerful sovereigns. And the fact that in Georgia they created magistrates very similar to England, where the courts would then have this kind of power. So Georgia may have been one of the exceptions out of the 10 where the courts might have been assuming power. I just don't have any evidence of that. But I'm just kind of helping you understand, folks, that Hamilton, out of all 13 states, he happened to live in a culture that was more like Britain than many of the other states. Many of the other states, because of what they did in 1763 by disbanding their government, when the states remolded their government, they made direct changes so that they didn't resemble Britain. At least most of them did that. Most of them was very guarded. They weren't happy with that framework of government. They wanted to make sure there was more protection. They didn't trust a centralized government. And so they didn't trust the courts either, because they saw the courts as basically an uncontrollable, non-answerable body of governing, which is one of the reasons why they kept them to literally handling cases, not messing around with law, case law precedents, that type of stuff. That was the commonality. So again, as we see Hamilton is thinking and operating in this paradigm of having this court more attuned or more like what we would call a British judiciary that had case law, that had precedents, interpretation, those things. Which is why he, as he's describing the judiciary, he knew that what came out of that Constitutional Convention had nothing to do with what he liked. The only thing they didn't cover in the Federalist Papers was the judiciary. So are you surprised, Sean, that all of a sudden when the Constitution's done and in secret, he starts describing the judiciary's powers as something more akin to Britain? And the ability to change law, the ability to redefine law, and even make law.
No, it in hindsight, it's pretty obvious that he's trying to convolute things to work the way that he intended.
Yes.
Outside of the basically enumerated.
Right. Excellent. Okay, so we just kind of, I think we wrapped up six, of 82. So let's dive into paragraph 7 of Federalist Paper 82. Thank you.
Here another question occurs. What relation would subsist between the national and state courts in these instances of concurrent jurisdiction? I answer that an appeal would certainly lie from the latter to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Constitution, in direct terms, gives an appellate jurisdiction to the Supreme Court in all the enumerated cases of federal cognizance in which it is not to have an original one, without a single expression to confine its operation to the inferior federal courts. The objects of appeal, not the tribunals from which it is to be made, are alone contemplated. From this circumstance and from the reason of the thing, it ought to be construed to extend to the state tribunals. Either this must be the case, or the local courts must be excluded from a concurrent jurisdiction in matters of national concern. Else the judiciary authority of the Union may be eluded at the pleasure of every plaintiff or prosecutor. Neither of these consequences ought, without evidence necessity, evident necessity to be involved. The latter would be entirely inadmissible, as it would defeat some of the most important and avowed purposes of the proposed government and would essentially embarrass its measures. Nor do I perceive any foundation for such a supposition. Agreeably to the remark already made, the national and state systems are to be regarded as one whole. The courts of the latter will, of course, be natural auxiliaries to the execution of the laws of the Union, and an appeal from them will as naturally lie to that tribunal which is destined to unite and assimilate the principles of national justice and the rules of national decisions. The evident aim of the plan of the convention is that all the causes of the specified classes shall, for weighty public reasons, receive their original or final determination in the courts of the Union. To confine, therefore, the general expression giving appellate jurisdiction to the Supreme Court to appeals from the subordinate federal courts instead of allowing their extension to the state courts would be to abridge the latitude of the terms in some version of the intent contrary to every sound rule of interpretation.
So, and there's the word interpretation, but it's not in relation to the law itself. So when I look at some of the things he's talking about, I mean, he's all over the place. Or what I should say is he's speaking in almost doublespeak, where it makes it confusing. Where does he really land on a state having concurrent jurisdiction? And I think where he kind of plays it, but the way it's flipped out there, I don't think you see it in how they wanted to go down this path. And it's kind of towards the middle top. It says either this must have, okay, let me read the top. The first two, a couple of sentences before this part. The objects of the appeal, not the tribunals from which it is made, are alone contemplated. From this circumstance and from the reason of the thing, it ought to be construed to extend to the state tribunals. Either this must be the case, or the local courts must be excluded from a concurrent jurisdiction in matters of national concern, else the judiciary authority of the Union may be eluded at the pleasure of the plaintiff or the prosecutor. Now, let me just dive into national concern. I'll give you Snowden as a case. When the federal government is, you know, created a, you know, spy governments, CIA, these agencies, right? These three-letter agencies that started spying on our enemies. Now everybody goes, hey, do they have that power? Do they have that authority? Well, yeah, because they do have a responsibility to protect our national security from external threats. So when Snowden went down the path of finding out that they were actually spying on people, they were collecting everything on all American citizens, which is a direct violation of the Constitution. Now, Snowden, being the immoral, self-aggrandizing narcissist, instead of taking a stand and taking this down to the state legislature in Hawaii, he took all of this data that he collected over the course of his entire career with the NSA and went abroad and gave this information to our foreign enemies so that they could exploit, and this is where sources as well as methods and technology and so forth and our capabilities, our national capabilities, was literally undermined. Literally, I mean, this was treason. However, on the premise that he's saying, hey, the federal government is doing something it doesn't have the authority to do. And he's absolutely right. Well, what do you do about that? Well, who has the responsibility when the federal government is exercising powers not delegated? Do you go to the courts? Is this a national matter that actually falls to the federal courts? Because what Hamilton is basically saying here, that the excluded from a concurrent jurisdiction in matters of national concern, no. Because the United States government has no constitutional authority to be spying on us. It directly violates our 14th Amendment, our Fourth Amendment rights. So this is where the states actually need to create, I'll just say, a small skiff connectivity between all of the state legislatures, so that when a citizen walks in to say, I've got evidence, classified evidence, that the federal government is violating their roles and responsibilities and basically assuming powers not granted and violating our rights by spying on us, then Snowden could have walked in, and he should have walked in. That's what he should have done to prove that the system is, you know, flawed, that there's no watcher of the watchers. There is a watcher of the watchers, folks. There is. It is the states. Madison told us this. But Snowden, being illiterate on the Constitution, thought, well, I can go make my 15 minutes of fame and a lot of money. And that's exactly what he did. Instead of actually solving the problem and saying, you know what, let me lead here, because, like you said, the guy's an idiot. At least he's completely illiterate on the Constitution. Some people say he's very smart. He's brilliant. I don't care. He sold us out. He committed treason. And he should hang for that. Because if he was truly principled and he truly cared about our rights, he would have been able to figure out that he needed to take this to the state legislature so that the states could do their job in holding the federal government accountable. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Now, I don't know. Yeah, I know that the Snowden thing is a huge trigger. It's a huge hot button that triggers, you know, libertarians and all these people, because they consider him a hero. So I don't think we've ever talked about Snowden, whether he's a hero to you or not, but I'm providing a paradigm or a perspective that, I mean, Snowden couldn't fathom, just because he didn't understand the Constitution. Well, he understood the Fourth Amendment was being violated, but I guess he couldn't just connect the dots that the states, you know, have this authority of oversight. And until you start reading these documents and understanding this, you know, a person that is poorly educated on the Constitution can be actually very dangerous. And Snowden proves that, because lives were lost. And technology and our ability to spy on foreign nations was truly compromised. Truly compromised. But anyway, but right here with Hamilton, let's pick on Hamilton now. Hamilton is basically saying anything of national concern. No. No. Only things arising under the Constitution. Right there, it conflates, you know, their jurisdiction into so many things. Well, it's national concern, like, you know, the production of salt, because that's how the nation preserves food. Well, we should bring that in. This is exactly how they started implying jurisdiction. Well, we consider that a national concern. You see my point?
Oh, yes, sir. I see it all around us today.
Yes. Okay. All right. So let's basically then look at the next paragraph. Thank you.
Paragraph 8.
Eight, yes.
But could an appeal be made to lie from the state courts to the subordinate federal adjudicatories? This is another of the questions which have been raised and of greater difficulty than the former. The following considerations countenance the affirmative. The plan of the convention, in the first place, authorizes the national legislature, quote, to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, end quote. It declares, in the next place, that, quote, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as Congress shall ordain and establish, end quote. And it then proceeds to enumerate the cases to which this judicial power shall extend. It afterwards divides the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court into original and appellate. It gives no definition of that of the subordinate courts. The only outlines described for them are that they shall be inferior to the Supreme Court, and that they shall not exceed the specified limits of the federal judiciary. Whether their authority shall be original or appellate, or both, is not declared. All this seems to be left to the discretion of the legislature. And this being the case, I perceive at present no impediment to the establishment of an appeal from the state courts to the subordinate national tribunals, and many advantages attending the power of doing it may be imagined. It would diminish the motives to the multiplication of federal courts, and would admit of arrangements calculated to contract the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. The state tribunals may then be left with a more entire charge of federal causes and appeals, in most cases in which they may be deemed proper, instead of being carried to the Supreme Court, may be made to lie from the state courts to district courts of the Union. It's funny how he quotes the parts that he likes and that work for his paradigm, but he leaves out the quotes of the other parts.
Yeah, and so, right, everything he's talking about here is about the authority of establishing courts. If you are operating on a paradigm of general power being granted, then you don't need to dive into, you know, the actual limited jurisdiction. If they can create the court, then that court can equally assume jurisdiction over all things. If you don't clearly delineate how limited it is. And when you go through the ratification debates, the Federalists are clearly delineating, hey, look, they can only pursue these things. So this, what he's saying here, is directly defying how all of the previous states from the Federalists who clarified that the court's jurisdiction is limited to the enumerated powers. That's it. If it's not enumerated, they can't meddle with it, just like the rest of the federal government. But Madison, you know, stated that very specifically throughout, like I said, even in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. But Hamilton is just, I mean, it's like taking the tablecloth and just, you know, with a quick whip of the tablecloth, flinging all of the ants off of the cloth and saying, there's nothing to worry about here, you know, and putting the food back on the table. And while you're sitting down, the ants will join you. Anyway. All right, let's do nine, because, yeah, everything he's talking about here is really, he's just talking about the power of establishing courts, but he's making them entwined, folding them together or conflating them into that jurisdiction. Yeah, there we go. All right, so again, McLean's edition for Federalist Paper number 83. So now we're literally down to the second to last one, and we're on page.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Uh-huh. In number 8 at the beginning, he says, this is another of the questions which have been raised and of greater difficulty than the former.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, who is raising the question?
There's the sophistry. See, there's the sophistry. All of the rest of the Federalist Papers, they started responding to the questions in the other newspapers. There was no newspaper, you know, question that had just come out from the previous, you know, articles on the judiciary. He's making it seem like these were tucked in, or these were actually a part of the Federalist Papers. So when you look at the Federalist Papers and somebody doesn't really pay attention, because you notice the dates right here, you see this? It says not dated in the Library of Congress. The Constitution Society dates this article as 5, 9, and 12 July in this one we're going to read. Even back in the original Federalist Papers, they didn't include the dates. Usually, the dates weren't included. If you go to the Avalon Project, I think you can find the dates. I think you might be able to find the dates. But when you're reading, you know, the books, or you're just consuming the Federalist Papers, they don't tell you the dates. One would think that the Federalist Papers were written right after the Constitutional Convention and sent out to all the states. And that is exactly how the judiciary and how the lawyers, I should say, the schools of law want you to treat the Federalist Papers like they were this, you know, comprehensive, you know, guide from the very beginning that everybody that was going through the ratification process, you know, used these as their guide in determining whether the Constitution should be ratified, which is a bunch of bull. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's, unless you want to add to that, I mean, yeah, he's a very devious person. But, you know, there are very few professions that are integrated into the profession and the education thereof is the art of deceit and lying. Deceit and lying. You know that, right? There's very few that have that. And lawyers is one. Acting is another. Or art is another. Because art is basically trying to, you know, especially abstract, those types of things, trying to convey something that, you know, is manufactured, something that's not true, what have you. There's even, in the intelligence community, in the human discipline, they learn to lie. And as a matter of fact, in the military, there's also the, the camouflage and deceptions, because, you know, they try to make something look like a target, so you blow up, you know, a little mound of dirt instead of, you know, a building. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you knew this, but I think they saw this in the Iranian war, where Iran actually had on its runways, because I saw this in the news, or one of the news, you know, things, that they actually had planes painted on their runways so that, you know, any novice military would actually fly in and just try to drop bombs on what they think are planes. But we don't fly in and do that. We have smart munitions that are targeted to go to very specific locations where we know the planes actually are, where we actually hit the planes where, you know, these other countries would actually drop bombs on, you know, pieces of asphalt. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Or the blow up tanks and
yeah,
such.
Right. Yeah. When it's really just a wagon that, you know, is made to look like a tank. so forth and so on. Yeah. That's called camouflage and conceal and deception, right? And it's all about lying and deceit. Getting somebody to think something's there or something isn't there. And lawyers are obviously trained in this because their job is to get you to think a certain way. Now, they don't say, hey, this is where we're going to teach you how to lie. They don't do that. But that's what they're doing. It's exactly what they're teaching, and that's what they're learning. And this is why, you know, if you believe anything that comes out of a lawyer's mouth or an entertainer's mouth or anybody that is, you know, out there being something that they're not, you know, a musician, an actor, that's their whole life, is I'm actually acting as somebody else. I am not really me, so what I am saying isn't really me, and they get very good at this. Which is why they
have 435 experts in Washington, D.C.
Politicians, yes, and a lot of politicians are lawyers or have a background in law, what have you. So anyway, without any further ado, let's go ahead and dive into paragraph two.
The objection to the plan of the convention, which has met with most success in this state, and perhaps in several of the other states.
And perhaps. he doesn't know that 9 states have already ratified it. And by this point in time, Virginia's ratified it. So 10 states. Perhaps it's been well received. This goes back to what you were saying, that he makes it sound like, these things were written a long time ago, long before, and that there's actually talking and answering questions and so forth when there was a vigorous debate, very vigorous debate. But this is back, this is when he's hiding in the evenings after the ratification debates in his office writing these things. Just so you're clear here, folks, just so we're clear here. Go ahead. Sorry.
Is that relative to the want of a constitutional provision for trial by jury in civil cases, the disingenuous form in which this objection is usually stated has been repeatedly adverted to and exposed, but continues to be pursued in all the conversations and writings of the opponents of the plan. The mere silence of the Constitution in regard to civil causes is represented as an abolition of the trial by jury, and the declamations to which it is afforded a pretext are artfully calculated to induce a persuasion that this pretended abolition is complete and universal, extending not only to every species of civil, but even to criminal causes. To argue with respect to the latter would, however, be as vain and fruitless as to attempt the serious proof of the existence of the matter, or to demonstrate any of those propositions which, by their own internal evidence, force conviction when expressed in language adapted to convey their meaning.
I just listen, and this is kind of starting off. He's giving you, kind of an upfront, okay, this is what we're going to dive into. But boy, he's really quick to point out how disingenuous and how hypocritical. And, this guy is on the pinnacle, the highest ground possible that any man could stand on. And yet he is in the lowest points, as we find out. Why did it take so long? And I understand that there are people out there that had uncovered all of these things about Hamilton that, I'll call them not what I would consider academic source documents. An academic source document is something he actually said, his actual writings and some of those things. And when we read the Federalist Papers, for years, folks, what we're reading now has been taken as gospel truth. Nobody saw when this was done. Nobody placed context to this. The fact that this was all being deviously done to help expand the power of the court. And yet, the court quickly nodded. I mean, if you walked into somebody's home and started talking about the placement of their home is, a place of, this high-value location, and, you ought to be awarded, that your home is an artifact of history and, it's worth millions of dollars, something like that, then you can see how somebody's, just playing you. But right here, nobody knows. Nobody has ever placed context to this. The thing that kills me, and this actually, because this concerns my wife, that now that I've exposed this, there's a lot of people that are not going to be happy. Those who've enjoyed and relished the power of the court and the power to create law and create case law or, bending and interpreting and the fun you have in doing such deceptive things. Hey, come on, they had a good ride, right? 200 plus years of fooling us. But why did it go so long? Why? Maybe that's just because there was nobody as stupid as me to be willing to actually come right out in front of this evil machine and say, you never had the authority, and we've actually uncovered the fact that this was perpetrated by Hamilton to give you powers when these powers directly conflict. You assume these powers using this document instead of actually being given these powers through the Constitution. And yet nobody batted an eye, and nobody's connected these dots. So, like I said, folks, they had a good run, but it's time to end the run. All right, paragraph three.
Paragraph three. With regard to civil causes, subtleties almost too contemptible for refutation have been employed to countenance the surmise that a thing which is not only not provided for is entirely abolished. Every man of discernment must at once perceive the wide difference between silence and abolition. But as the inventors of this fallacy have attempted to support it by certain legal maxims of interpretation, which they have perverted from their true meaning, it may not be wholly useless to explore the ground they have taken.
Wow.
Who is he talking about?
Yeah, you know what? This is where he just starts babbling. When we get into the ratification debates right after this, because we've only got two more Federalist Papers. No, one more. When we get into his talking, he starts talking about theory to where, you know, even the most, you know, uneducated person can see the sense and this. And it was just like, wow, he's just wandering out there about talking so much about nothing. But he's using his literacy, his knowledge on these, you know, ancient works, documents, so forth in history, that he's kind of creating this connection to stuff, but it's not connected at all. And I'm going, what a waste of time. I think that most people, this is probably one of the reasons why he spoke so little in the ratification debates. If you look and you counted which delegates spoke the most, you know, you put a mark next to their name, you know, you had everybody up in a spreadsheet, put a mark next to their name every time they got up and spoke. Hamilton spoke less than 20 times, period. Less than 20 times. I think it's like just barely over 10. So the question is, if that's the case, then, you know, what was he saying? What was he doing? And what did people think? Obviously, I think they just thought he was a blowhard. And I believe, and this is my supposition, and I've said this for years and years, I believe Hamilton didn't care about the issues, which is one of the reasons why I've never taken the New York debates seriously. Because when you read what Hamilton said, I mean, it was just like milquetoast. It just, you know, really weak. And I'm going, okay, well, you know, that doesn't lend to any, you know, real, you know, standing up and providing the exact same definitions. New York, out of the vigorously debated ratification debates, it is the outlier. And I'm going, you know, there's a little meat, but it's not what you would think. And so I go, well, why is that? And because Hamilton was banking on New York ratifying if Virginia did. And as soon as he found out Virginia did, which I think was, like I said, we can look at it. I think it was July 20-something or June 20-something. Shortly after New York started their debates, they got the word, which then Hamilton said, I don't need to speak that much. And the more he had to speak, so he only jumped in on issues. And in some ways, I think he used the art of confusing people more than anything else to say, wow, that sounded like, you know, sounded like he was talking to those who were really educated, so I don't want to seem stupid and say anything about it. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anyway, so let's go to the next
one. You got the race in the bag and you got the plan already made up. You don't want to rock the boat too much because then something might mess up your plan.
Right. Yeah, and that all, see, all that stuff makes sense. All that stuff makes sense. Go ahead, let's do the next one.
Number
four.
Three.
Four.
Four. Okay. The maxims on which they rely are of this nature. Quote, a specification of particulars is an exclusion of generals. Or, quote, the expression of one thing is the exclusion of another, end quote. Hence, say they, as the Constitution has established a trial by jury in criminal cases and is silent in respect to civil, this silence is an implied prohibition of trial by jury in regard to the latter.
Okay, is it? Let's keep going.
Number five, the rules of legal interpretation are rules of common sense, adopted by the courts in the construction of the laws. The true test, therefore, of a just application of them is its conformity to the source from which they are derived. This being the case, let me ask if it is consistent with common sense to suppose that a provision obliging the legislative power to commit the trial of criminal causes to juries is a privation of its right to authorize or permit that mode of trial in other cases? Is it natural to suppose that a command to do one thing is a prohibition to the doing of another, which there was a previous power to do, and which is not incompatible with the thing commanded to be done? If such a supposition would be unnatural and unreasonable, it cannot be rational to maintain that an injunction of the trial by jury in certain cases is an interdiction of it in others.
It's doublespeak. I, you know, I'm not defending the guy, but I can understand where I think you just use doublespeak, but I can also think that sometimes when you give people way too much information, that it makes it hard for them to understand, because you've just put out all these different examples and metaphors, and the confusion of metaphors can actually permeate into, you know, what did he say? Because you may be talking to him, and they say, you know, always talk down, right? They tell you to talk to the lowest education level, the lowest, you know, mind in the audience, so that everybody can get what you're saying. That's the most important thing of an orator. And, you know, I get that. I understand that. And a lot of times I'm guilty of not talking down. But this right here is pure. I mean, it's one thing because I've been accused of saying way too much and giving way too much content where people had to, you know, wow, you covered so much stuff there. I don't know what's important to keep, that type of stuff. I get that. But was there anything there that he read in five that was something substantive?
No, sir.
It's all generalities. I mean, I think he started off with this, the metaphorical, you know, or actually it was the one before. Hence, they say, as the Constitution is, or actually, a specification of particulars is an exclusion of generals. Or, and then he gives you this other thing. It's just like doublespeak. And then he just goes on. And next thing you know, you're looking at your watch and going, okay, it's been 10 minutes. What does this have to do with the specification of particulars as an exclusion of generals? Well, what? Okay. So, and I think that this is where we really probably will find, you know, these just wasted pages. Let's go ahead. Paragraph six.
Number five, the rules of legal interpretation. Oh, wait, did I just read that? Yeah.
Yep. I'm sorry, number seven. Six. Oh, okay. I thought you... Okay, go ahead.
A power to constitute courts is a power to prescribe the mode of trial. And consequently, if nothing was said in the Constitution on the subject of juries, the legislature would be at liberty either to adopt that institution or to let it alone. This discretion in regard to criminal causes is abridged by the express injunction of trial by jury in all such cases. But it is, of course, left at large in relation to civil causes, there being a total silence on this head. The specification of an obligation to try all criminal causes in a particular mode excludes indeed the obligation or necessity of employing the same mode in civil causes, but does not abridge the power of the legislature to exercise that mode if it should be thought proper. The pretense, therefore, that the national legislature would not be at full liberty to submit all the civil causes of federal cognizance to the determination of juries is a pretense destitute of all just foundation.
Wow. Yeah. And so he again is taking six. I think this has all been over the fact that somebody, probably in the Federalist or in the ratification debates, talked about, you know, the omission of a trial by jury over civil cases, not, you know, but in trial, you shall have it in all criminal cases. But what about these other cases? Well, it would be based on case by case or what have you, whatever. And when you read the ratification debates, you know, the other ratification debates where they're talking about this, because this is a hot contended item, you'll see this. And you'll go, wow, I mean, okay, they actually kind of addressed it without going through this such a confusing dialogue over why was it not, you know, demanded that a trial by jury must be done for all things. Only, and as a matter of fact, I believe common law dictates that when you deal with crimes, it dictates that you be tried by a trial by jury, but it doesn't dictate that in like contract law or, you know, other disputes, property disputes or what have you. However, in many cases in common law, this goes down, and we actually see this explained in Madison's Notes on the Constitutional Convention, where they talked about how different states had deployed common law, or I should say trial by jury, differently. In other words, it wasn't extended to these other cases the way they did it. Now, as I said kind of at the beginning, Hamilton is in New York, and the New York paradigm must be that trial by jury is extended to everything. Or at least that's what people are presuming, because they live in New York. And throughout the Constitutional Convention, obviously there was debate in not extending it, because other cultures didn't have that. So what ended up going into the Constitution was the language that made it seem like it was excluded. But the point is that he's taking such a long time just trying to say, hey, it is required for all crimes, and it is up to determination on everything else, whether you have a trial by jury. It's not excluded. It doesn't say there will be no other trial by jury in any other case, or any other trial, or type of trial. Anyway, let's keep going.
Number 7. From these observations, this conclusion results that the trial by jury in civil cases would not be abolished, and that the use attempted to be made of the maxims which have been quoted is contrary to reason and common sense, and therefore not admissible. Even if these maxims had a precise technical sense, corresponding with the idea of those who employed them upon the present occasion, which, however, is not the case, they would still be inapplicable to a constitution of government. In relation to such a subject, the natural and obvious sense of its provisions, apart from any technical rules, is a true criterion of construction.
Okay, let's keep going. I could just keep on saying the exact same thing over and over again.
Number 8, having now seen that the maxim relied upon will not bear the use made of them, let us endeavor to ascertain their proper use and true meaning. This will be best done by examples. The plan of the convention declares that the power of Congress, or, in other words, of the national legislature, shall extend to certain enumerated cases. This specification of particulars evidently excludes all pretension to a general legislative authority, because an affirmative grant of special powers would be absurd as well as useless if a general authority was intended.
Okay.
In like manner, the judicial authority of the federal judicatures is declared by the Constitution to comprehend certain cases particularly specified. The expression of those cases marks the precise limits beyond which the federal courts cannot extend their jurisdiction, because the objects of their cognizance being enumerated, the specification would be nugatory if it did not exclude all ideas of more extensive authority.
Okay, let me just say this. The Constitution does not cover common law. And when we go through the ratification debates, there was only a few states that picked that up. They noticed that. Hey, it didn't mention the jurisdiction over common law. And so Hamilton isn't even bringing that up, where they only have the jurisdiction over what's provided, not what isn't listed there. And so I think that it kind of skims over that. And I think that he's taking advantage of that with this voluminous language with a lacking of going into the, because he's talking about clearly enumerations right here. He's literally saying that these enumerations, you know, to the general legislature or the national legislature, Congress, are these ways. So it would be the same with the courts. And then he ends it up with, because an affirmative grant of special powers would be absurd as well as useless if a general authority is intended. Okay, I get that. Now, in this next one, in the like manner of the judicial authority over the federal judicators, I think this is what you're going to read, you know, he still doesn't get into the fact. He just doesn't cover the fact that if it's not delegated, they can't do it, that they don't have general jurisdiction at all. Go ahead.
Number 10. These examples are sufficient to elucidate the maxims which have been mentioned and to designate the manner in which they should be used. But that there may be no misapprehension upon the subject, I shall add one case more to demonstrate the proper use of these maxims and the abuse which has been made of them. Let us suppose by the laws of this state, a married woman was incapable of conveying her estate. I don't think we have time to get through this.
Okay. You're right. We don't. So we'll just pick it up with this one.
Number 11.
Yeah, with this one when we come back tomorrow. And now he's giving the case. So now we might be able to dive into some stuff. But this is all generals, and it's interesting. But folks, when it comes down to actually specifying what they can do, what they can't do, and distilling it down so that anybody can walk away with a very simple understanding, there are some of us that have a struggle at doing that, and there are some that deliberately make sure that you don't walk away with a clear understanding. And I think Hamilton is obviously playing in that part. You know, it's not that he, you know, is just too educated to be able to dumb it down. I think that he's deliberately making it so that nobody wants to challenge him. Like I said earlier, I think that many times when he goes into his orations, he just tries to impress people of how smart he is, because then nobody would ask questions because they don't understand what he said. He's a very smart man, very literate, very well educated. And with that, we'll just close it here. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.